Okay, let's read it, and then write about it. Nelda, you want to read it?
Yes, thank you. This song asked Fionn, "Where are you going?" Fionn said, "Around on pilgrimage." This song said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Fionn said, "I don't know." This song said, "Not knowing is most intimate."
And then from the Book of Serenity, it's not knowing is nearest.
Yeah. Nearest to what?
I'm
Well,
sorry, what?
I asked out loud what was in my mind, nearest to what, but I think I have at least one answer. But not now.
And what does it do when you're in a relationship and you know, as opposed to not knowing?
Depends on your level of flexibility, I think, because it's silly and unwise to forget what we've learned about someone in a relationship. At the same time, it's rigid and constricting to not have the flexibility to be open to change in others and ourselves.
I'm glad you're back. Ramona,
Yes.
you want to read?
Yes. Dizang asked Fion, "Where are you going?" Fion said, "Around on pilgrimage." Dizang said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Fion said, "I don't know." Dizang said, "Not knowing is most intimate."
Thank you. And Melissa, you can choose any ending you want. I mean, either of the endings.
Dizong asked Fion, "Where are you going?" Fion said, "Around on pilgrimage." Dizong said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Fion said, "I don't know." Dizong said, "Not knowing is nearest."
Thank you, Donna.
Taizan asked Feon, "Where are you going?" Feon said, "Around on pilgrimage." Taizong said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Feon said, "I don't know." Taizong said, "Not knowing is most intimate."
Thank you. And Milan?
Dizong asked Fayan, "Where are you going?" Fayan said, "Around on pilgrimage." Dizong said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Fayan said, "I don't know." Dizong said, "Not knowing is most intimate."
Okay, let's write for 10 minutes on whatever is touching you about this now.
I have kept the idea of not knowing with me since joining this group last week. It's been a comfort, as I tend to be a planner and a worrier. I want to plan for all contingencies, which drains my energy and makes me less resourceful rather than more able to cope with whatever comes up. I had plenty I could worry about. My son is facing challenges far away from me, so it's difficult to help him. My dog has been sick for a yet unknown reason. These things are still on my mind and heart, but I did not feel consumed by worry. I don't have to know how they will turn out in order to be present with my loved ones.
Thank you. Who would like to go next?
I can, yeah. Most intimate, not knowing. When is the time that it is most intimate? I think the time in a relationship or when traveling, when you don't really know the person or place. When a person, it is when you are choosing what you want the other person to know about you. The more you share and see the reactions of that person, you know just how intimate, how much of your real self you want to share. If the person you're sharing with listens intently and waits for you to stop speaking before asking you questions, you may feel safe enough to share more, to share deeper thoughts and deeper happenings. If they pummel you with questions and don't really seem to listen to or care for your answers, you know this is not a person to be intimate with or to get close to. Places become intimate, especially on a pilgrimage, walking up a hill on a path you don't know, seeing things, new types of flowers, someone on a bike, not speaking but waving in acknowledgement, a tiny chapel with room for only a few. That's as far as I got.
Thank you.
That little chapel was in Greece. Wonderful.
And you were on a pilgrimage?
In many ways, yes.
And Donna?
Yes, I have some images. Okay, cool. So for me, I focus very much on the line, not knowing, what is it? Not knowing is intimate.
It's most intimate.
Most intimate. I absolutely love that. Not knowing is most intimate. It's so beautiful. The words are so beautiful. So my image, oops, I'm sorry. This, I should warn you. One's a little, how can I say it? Graphic?
There's beauty in nudity.
Yeah.
So for me, I kept thinking, what's most intimate? And oh, the second one that says nearest. And I thought the nearest thing to me is the creation of the universe. So I said a human being wrapped up in the universe. Mm-hmm. And so this is what AI created. And I just love the idea of that, you know, like being part of the universe and wrapped up in the universe. And, you know, it's like not even being born yet, that moment of that's so intimate, just the unknowingness of just birth of the universe, birth of humanness. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna.
Thank you, Don.
in Lynn or Nelda. Are you still in Cancun?
I'm in Tulum.
Where are you?
Tulum, 1 hour away.
Oh, okay.
It's beautiful. Not knowing if nearest, what is farthest? Not knowing is most intimate. What is the most distant? Those were my reflections.
That's so great.
Thank you.
And Nelda?
So mine's a scrambled mess, so I ask your patience. Not knowing is nearest. Not knowing. No set ideas, no constructs or paradigms with their inherent limitations is nearest. Not knowing what? What is it about not knowing that brings it nearest? What does it bring nearest? I find that for me, what it brings nearest and what is most life nourishing in not knowing is the excitement, the exciting element of curiosity that comes about in the not knowing. Curiosity is ignited in this formless field of benefaction with the not knowing. It brings everything closer for our examination. And this not knowing, curiosity that arises, in this curiosity that arises, we become closest, nearest to seeing, to experiencing life in all its complexity and ever evolving formless form. This was brought nearest to me on my trip to Antarctica. I didn't read about Antarctica. I didn't want to. I didn't want ideas cluttering my mind. I knew it would be cold. For me, anything under 72 degrees is cold. So I knew it would be cold, but I didn't know how cold, what kind of cold, what the sky would be like, what the ground would be like. I've been asked by many people, what was it like? Was it pretty? And I get very frustrated with that sort of question, because that's like limiting any of you to one element. What is Donna like? What is Melissa like? Kim, are they pretty? I think if the only reason you go to a place like Antarctica is to find out if it's pretty, you're wasting your money. What I found in Antarctica was that it was an living, growing, evolving, nurturing organism, a complete, complex, and changing organism that is 1.5 times the size of the United States. It was daunting to get there. I didn't know about that. Had I known, I might not have gone. But I'm glad I did. And I'll go again. And I'll go back to the same places because I'm sure there's so much that was not nearest to me in those moments that I'd like to look at again with that curiosity that was ignited. And I'll go to other places on the eastern side rather than the western side of Antarctica to see how this organism that sustains the entire world, and that's a true statement, nurtures itself and all of us. So that's for me. But not knowing is nearest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I like that idea of curiosity being kind of the result of not knowing.
It's the gift. It's the gift of not knowing. It really is.
Nearest. To get really close, our eyes blur. To get even closer, we bump our forehead. We are in contact with something. When we get near, near takes us something, takes us. To something else. What is intimate? It is sometimes referred to as having knowledge of. As we get closer, we drop our prejudices and assumptions. We realize that all we have are surprises, like when we walk in the snow. We can look back and see our path, but we look forward and just see 2 feet of snow. I don't know. There's a particular field in my childhood, a certain day. It was a day camp, and we were out in a park, and it had just snowed the night before. And I walked to a certain place in the field, and there were no trees in this big field, just surrounded by trees. And then I looked back and saw the path, and looked forward and just saw snow, you know, everywhere I could look. Okay. Should we read Norman Fisher now? So we're going to start. We're not meeting next week because of the intensive, and then the week. Just let Donna. We're not meeting next week, and then the week after we're going to start. And Ann Lipscomb is going to join us, and we're going to start reading The Four Noble Truths by Bhikkhu Bodhi. We'll be sharing the book, and we'll read that, and then we'll do more koans when that is done. So, what did I just promise you? Oh, Norman Fisher. Okay, I can do it. I'm making great progress here. Here we go. Okay, this is from 2006. And let's go in alphabetical order. So Donna is first, and then Kim, then Melissa, Malin, Nelda, and Ramona.
Many teachers have made this one phrase, not knowing is most intimate, the heart of their teaching, repeating it over and over again. But what does it mean, and how can we make use of it for our lives?
You can read more.
Oh. Dai Zeng asked Fion, where are you going? Fion said, around on pilgrimage. Dai Zeng said, what is the purpose of pilgrimage? Fion said, I don't know. Dai Zeng said, not knowing is most intimate.
This is one of the greatest teaching stories in all of Zen. Many teachers have made this one phrase, not knowing is most intimate, the heart of their teaching, repeating it over and over again. But what does it mean? And how can we make use of it for our lives? First of all, let me back up and say something basic about Zen practice. As one of my teachers used to put it, Zen is a practice of phrases. The practice of phrases isn't limited to Zen. It's common in almost all religious traditions. When Christians read, memorize, and reflect on scripture, when Jews or Muslims sing daily prayers, when words affect their hearts beyond their thinking minds, they are practicing phrases. In Zen, we practice with phrases like this. We take a phrase like not knowing is most intimate, or just not knowing, and we bring it into our sitting. We breathe with it in meditation practice. repeating it again and again, usually on the exhale. Eventually letting go of the words and just feeling the breath as the phrase. We repeat the phrase to ourselves during the day and begin to notice it coming up spontaneously from time to time. The phrase becomes a theme of our daily activity. It begins to influence us, bringing ordinary daily occurrences to a deeper and more mysterious level. The point is not to think about the phrase, to figure out what it means. The point is to keep chewing on it, holding it as a talisman, until suddenly or gradually it reveals itself to us. Working with the phrase in this way, we go beyond our usual understanding of things. We do not impose the phrase as something extra added on to our experience. Rather, it is as if the phrase reveals to us the inner essence of our experience, which we might have been taking for granted for a long time. The phrase opens us to what matters most, to what was there all along within us, but we hadn't noticed it before. The practice of phrases brings us closer, deeper to our lives, beyond our unexamined habits and notions. That's really special, isn't it?
Mm. Definitely. In our story, Daizong is asking Fayon not just about pilgrimage, but about the spiritual practice, about life itself. For life is, after all, nothing but a pilgrimage. What is the purpose? Why are we born? Why do we die? Why is life so difficult? What are we always longing for? Why are we always longing for something else? What do we really know of our mysterious and fleeting experience? And Fion's response is pretty honest. He doesn't just come out with some pious Buddhist answer, though we can be sure he knows many such answers. I don't know, he says honestly and humbly, perhaps expecting Daizong, his teacher, to shed some light on the question. But Daizong says, I don't know. It's just right. I don't know is most intimate. Fayon is awakened by Daizong's response. He suddenly recognizes, as one often does in spiritual practice, that he had what he needed all along. Only he didn't know it. The way is right beneath your feet and every blade and in every blade of grass.
Melissa, as you were reading your thoughts earlier, I was thinking, do we even know ourselves? Or, you know, I don't think I do. But you were talking about someone else knowing you, right?
Right.
Yeah, but
I felt the same way when I was writing it. You can do the same thing within yourself. I find myself doing that, asking my own questions to myself.
And would you want to know yourself?
I don't know. I don't know.
why would you not? Why would you not want to know the hidden treasures and broken places through which the light comes in? Why would you not? I just can't imagine knowing.
Do you know yourself?
Absolutely not.
Oh, good. Okay. So my joke with my grandkids, did I tell you guys this? Je ne sais pas in French is I do not know. And like, I can pull this on them, like every year I'll say, so what's je ne sais pas? And they'll be really confused. They'll say, I don't know.
I love that. I'm going to try it on my grandchildren.
Yeah. Okay. So I think, Malin.
In Zen, the word intimacy is synonym of awakening or enlightenment. And for me, intimacy is a much better word than these others. Zen enlightenment, realization, or awakening, all these words seem to imply some special state of mind or spirit. some kind of transformative mystical knowledge or experience that somehow will bring us beyond life's day-to-day problems to a more spiritual plane. The world intimacy is better. The word intimacy is better. It sounds like we are getting closer, deeper, more loving with our experience rather than somehow beyond it. Intimacy better expresses what enlightenment really feels like, I think. So how is that not knowing is most intimate?
You know, we have the words wisdom and then wisdom beyond wisdom. And I think that wisdom beyond wisdom is the same thing that he's talking about, where wisdom is kind of like knowing to me, and wisdom without wisdom, beyond wisdom, is going deeper into the mystery.
Another Zen master once said, "The way is vast and wide. How could it ever be a matter of knowing or not knowing? Knowing is arrogant." Oh, that's so true. "Knowing is arrogant. Not knowing is stupidity. The way is far beyond both of these." This tells us that Disang's not knowing is something more and less than the conventional idea of not knowing, which implies that there is something to be known, only we don't know it. Too bad for us. We are stupid. Probably someone else smarter than us knows, and maybe we can learn from them. We can take a training course, improve our skills, and maybe eventually we too will know. And when we know, we will be the smart ones, and we can start our own training course and teach other people. Then we can feel good about ourselves, knowing how much smarter we are than the others. Meanwhile, we pretend we know. Of course we know. We are mature people of the world. We know plenty. But deep down, we know we don't know. The things that matter most escape us entirely. But it's too much for us to admit this, certainly not to another person, and sometimes not even to ourselves. So we show up to work or to our relationships as if we know. We stake out roles, identities, skills, viewpoints, and we defend them. We get into plenty of trouble this way.
Daizong's not knowing isn't like this. It's not the opposite of knowing. It's beyond both knowing and not knowing. Or, to put it another way, it's the real not knowing. When we know something and rest in that knowing, we limit our vision. We only see what our knowing will allow us to see. In this way, our experience can be our enemy. True, our experience has shown us something about ourselves and about life. But this moment, this situation that faces us right now, this patient, this person, this family, this illness, this task, this pain or beauty, we have never seen it before. What is it? How do we respond? I don't know. I bow before the beauty and uniqueness of what I am facing. Not knowing, I'm ready to be surprised, ready to listen and understand, ready to respond as needed, ready to let others respond, ready to do nothing at all, if that's what's called for. I can be informed by my past experience, but it is much better if I am ready and able to let that go and just be present, just listen, just not know. Experience, knowledge, wisdom, these are good, but when I examine things closely, I can see that they remove me from what's in front of me. When I know, I bring myself forward, imposing myself and my experience on this moment. When I don't know, I let experience come forward and reveal itself. When I can let go of my experience, knowledge, and wisdom, I can be humble in the face of what is. And when I'm humble, I am ready to be truly fearless and intimate. I can enter into this moment, which is always a new relationship, always fresh. I can be moved by what happens, fully engaged and open to what the situation will show me.
Oh, that's a beautiful paragraph too.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? It is.
It is.
My favorite sentence is, I bow before the beauty and uniqueness of what I'm facing.
Mm-hmm.
So beautiful.
He is so good at expressing himself, mm-hmm. and also understanding, but I guess it takes both. So, Donna?
Good idea. Probably have all heard about it before, but how do we practice it? How do we make it a way we live rather than a good idea we aspire to and never achieve? So that instead of something useful to us, it becomes yet another way, a more spiritual way for us to berate ourselves. In commenting De Zong phrase, Shizhao said, in walking, in sitting, just hold to the moment before thought arises. Look into it, and you'll see not seeing. And then put it to one side. When you direct your effort like this, rest does not interfere with meditation study. Meditation study does not interfere with rest.
This is the simplest thing. It's the way we practice meditation. And when we train ourselves this way on our cushions, it spills over into our daily lives. We sit with awareness of the body, the breath. We let thought and feeling arise, but we don't make something out of it. We let it come, we appreciate it, we let it go. We don't take it personally. We don't get tangled up in it. A thought arising in the mind is just something happening, the way a bird singing in a tree or a truck rumbling by on the street are things happening. All experience comes and goes. All experience is us, our life. When we practice this way, judgments begin to fall away. We forgive ourselves for being who we are. Naturally, we are that. Everything just is as it is. We don't have to divide things into me and not me, into good and bad, desirable and undesirable. We know, yes, this is a bird. It is outside. This is a thought. It is inside. But also at the same time, we know outside and inside, it is all just life. We might say this impulse is good, this impulse is bad, but also we know all things rise and pass away, so it's okay. Everything has its place. Another teacher said, just affirm totally when affirming, but don't settle down in affirmation. Just deny totally when denying, but don't settle down in denial. When you train in being present and letting things come and go, you are training in not knowing. Without not knowing, we make determinations and take actions. Every moment calls on us to respond, and we do freely and with full confidence. Sometimes affirmation is called for, sometimes denial. There are no rules. But whichever it is, we don't settle down there. We don't identify and dig in. We stand in not knowing, ready for the next moment to be different. I think that last line is really important, that we don't know what the next moment is going to bring. And so some people say that there's no such thing as cause and effect for that reason, because you don't know what a cause, what the effect will be from a cause. You know, you can predict, well, it probably, when I drop this glass, it will probably break, but you really don't know, and it's all a surprise.
Yeah, and it relates with a paragraph above that says that when we know, we limit our experience to our knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So, is it possible to be lost? I don't know.
What do you mean by lost?
I don't know. I don't know.
Depends on being lost.
Is it possible not to be lost?
You mean not lost? You know, it just depends on how you define it.
Yeah.
I love that. All thought, impulse, and action from not knowing whether we know it or not. In other words, this world arises moment after moment out of silence, consciousness, God, or whatever you want to call it. When we return over...
Wait, is that where we are?
I don't know.
Maybe
we skipped a short paragraph.
I'm walking.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm walking and sitting. Just hold to the moment before the thought arises. Look into it and you'll see not seeing. And then put it to one side. When you direct your effort like this, rest does not interfere with meditation study, and meditation study does not interfere with rest. All thought, impulse, and action comes from our not knowing, whether we know it or not. In other words, this world arises moment after moment out of silence, consciousness, God, or whatever you want to call it. When we return over and over again to awareness of body, of breath, to the present moment of being alive, we are returning to this pre-reflective moment, this moment beyond knowing and not knowing from which all springs. This is not something we can exactly do or even intend. We can make an effort, but in the end, it happens by itself. Because we are that, and there is no other way. All being is that. All being arises from the silence within. But we don't settle down in that, because we can't. As soon as we try to settle down in it, we've created another moment of knowing, another moment of passion and identity, which is granted to cause us and others suffering down the line. So we appreciate the almost non-existent moment before things arise, and then we move on. We put it to one side, we let it go. We return to intimacy, not knowing, to not knowing, to the simple willingness to be present with what it is, just to be there without preconceptions. When we practice like this, meditation and non-meditation are the same thing. We don't have to worry about our performance. We just do our best and accept the consequences.
Isn't that something? Hmm. Meditation and non-meditation are the same thing. When we're doubting whether we're really meditating, he's so wise. Okay, Milan.
A poem on Dizeng's not knowing says, let it be short or let it be long. Stop cutting and plunging. Going along with the high along with the low, it lives, it levels itself. The abundance or
scarcity.
Oh, scarcity, thank you. Can you continue, please, reading? I can't.
Okay. The abundance or scarcity of the house is used according to the occasion. Roaming serenely in the land, she goes where her feet take her. And now, Nelda.
I said that returning to the pre-reflective moment is not something we can do or intend. So it is both very easy and impossibly difficult. Easy because there's nothing to do. Just keep on making effort, but an easeful effort. Be persistent in your practice, but don't worry about anything. Rest assured that you will get what you need and that the way will unfold before you. And difficult because we are so convinced that we need to do something, know something, be something that we are not, that we keep beating our head against a wall. But no matter how hard we beat, the wall remains and we have a headache. Because we can't help going on being ourselves, victims of our habits and concepts, it's possible we need to beat our head against the wall for a while, long enough to understand that this particular brand of pain is not and never was necessary. And that is very stupid. Eventually we get it. Not knowing is most intimate. We can know something or not know something. We ought to study and learn so that we can know more, and especially so that we can know what we don't know and be humble about that. Everyone knows something and doesn't know something. This is as true of the wise and the powerful as it is of the simple and unschooled. But beyond what we know and don't know is Desang's not knowing is most intimate. Being close to our experience, willing to enter completely with empty hands into every moment of encounter is something we must surrender ourselves to. Sometimes we can do this, sometimes we can't. Doesn't matter. What matters is that we keep on trying, trusting that what happens is what needs to happen.
Surrender seems important to me, that we surrender to not knowing.
I have a beautiful little quote that I took off one of Appomattos old calendars and brought home and laminated. And I think it's a Joan Sutherland, and I'm going to paraphrase it and butcher it probably. But it starts out, just let go. Let go and deliver yourself to the moment that is unfolding before you in your life right now. It's just such a beautiful thought to remember. Just let go.
There's another funny, oh, I'll wait.
Oh, I just said thank you, Nelda.
Oh, okay. There's another funny commentary to Daizong's not knowing that takes the form of a conversation between the parts of the face. The mouth says to the nose, I do the eating, I do the talking. What could be more important than that? So why are you above me? And the nose says, quoting an old Chinese proverb, among the five mountains, the central one occupies the honorable position. So why, the nose goes on, addressing the eyes, are you above me? And the eyes reply, we are like the sun and moon. We have the power of illumination and reflection. But the question is, eyebrows, why are you above us? The eyebrows don't know anything. They have no powers whatsoever. They can't eat, speak, smell, see, hear. And yet they are the highest. They reply, we are embarrassed to be above all of you. And we have no idea why. Another master commenting on this commentary said,
In the eyes, it's called seeing. In the ears, it's called hearing. But what is it called in the eyebrows? Then after a long silence, he said, in sorrow, we grieve together. In happiness, we rejoice together. Everyone knows the useful function, but no one appreciates the supreme power of the usefulness.
No.
Useless.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone knows the useful function, but no one appreciates the supreme power of the useless.
Yeah. Mm. Norman Fisher can write like a fiend, can't he?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's so generous.
Yes.
He really cares about trying to get people to understand, not to just show off.
Yeah.
What's the name of the book? I missed that.
Well, it's not a book.
It's not a book. Okay.
His website, his kind of Zendo is, that doesn't have a location, is Everyday Zen Foundation.
Okay.
Can you send this link to us when at some time when you have a moment?
If I put it in chat, will that work?
Yes, yes, yes. That'd be great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, one more paragraph, Donna.
I think Donna's next. To me, this is very beautiful. Life is just that, don't you think? When sorrow comes, we grieve. But it's not so bad because we grieve together, intimately. Even the trees hang low and the flowers droop. And this intimacy makes the sorrow poignant and beautiful. When happiness comes, we rejoice. But we don't need to feel guilty or worry that somehow we will lose our happiness because it isn't ours. We are happy intimately together with everyone and everything. If we are willing to grieve together with everything, then we can be happy together with everything without holding back. We know that happiness won't last, that it will go, come back, go again, and come back again. But that's okay. How could it be otherwise? That's a place of useful function for knowing, for learning, for skill. Without the eyes, the nose, and the mouth, the world as we know it wouldn't appear. But without the useless function, without not knowing, the world would never be. To practice not knowing is nearer, is to return to the heart of the world, moment after moment. The eyebrows are very humble. They don't know anything, and they don't do anything, but they are the highest of all.
Thank you, Kim, for sharing this. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
So Wednesday night, what's happening now to Wednesday night? I can't remember.
We have a koan. I don't know what it is yet.
The koan meditation, and who's going to lead it?
Well, everyone.
But Nelda is going to lead it Wednesday night.
I get to call on people. Or ask volunteers.
And will you do a reminder, Nelda?
Yes, but we'll have to talk. Do you have a few minutes after this?
I do.
Okay.
And so I hope you all can come. I'm in a class, so I can't come. But unless you have a good excuse. Nelda,
what time is it? Is it at 7?
7, yes. Huh? It's called Wednesday Night Meditation Koan Practice, something like that.
Okay.
on the calendar.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And also,
Koan practice is my favorite. Look. Because I always get the answer wrong, and I love that. This one, I think I know something. I don't know anything, but I learn from each of you, and that's what expands my practice. So it's lovely.
And Thursday night, we're going to have Zen writing, and we're going to use a very ingenious means to write that we did Sunday. So if some of you were there Sunday, we're going to try it again on Thursday night.
That's going to be very cool. It was really cool on Sunday when we did it.
There are many ways to write that we haven't tried.
Look forward to it.
And so our next time will be in 2 weeks with the Four Noble Truths.
Excellent.
And I think it will be fun after reading the Four Noble Truths to come back to the koans and to apply some of the stuff we learn to the koans.
I'm just curious, which part of the Serenity book are we?
Oh, this is the 20th.
Out of
100.
Okay.
Yeah, 2 years, Malin. We'll be doing this for 2 years.
Or maybe longer if we take breaks every 20 koans.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, thank Donna, you. Donna, the picture you sent me earlier today, do you have that? That was a real beauty.
Yeah, I do.
Show that to them. I think they'll enjoy that.
I'm getting it. Looking for it. How come I can't? Hold on.
So is and leading the reading of the next book?
No, we're sharing the leading.
Okay. And are you going to send the information of the book so we can buy it?
Sure. I can put it in chat. It's called The Four Noble Truths by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And there's one that's a PDF that he wrote that's about 20 years ago, but this is much more than that.
Is it a particular edition, Kim?
Yeah, it is, and that's what I'm going to if you can copy this oops. Here we go. We'll be sharing the book on screen, but if you want to buy it.
Still disabled.
What's disabled?
The share feature?
No, it shouldn't be.
No.
Oh, here. No, but I may. Here, I'll do it again. Oh, I know. You left and came back.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. There it is.
See it. 1, 4, 2, 9, 7, 9, 8.
Oh. So for me, this was about it was the story about what was it? Oh, you know, it could be good, it could be bad. So this was the image from that.
Oh,
I like that.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I put it in the announcement, and it's the man who whose horse runs away.
Yes,
come
yes.
To console him, and then many horses come back, and
yes.
They congratulate him, and then his son breaks his leg, and the neighbors console him, and then he's not drafted, and they come to congratulate him.
Yes, so that's what this image is based on, that piece of writing.
Beautiful.
And what were some of your instructions to get AI to make this?
I asked it to, I envision my positive and negative side, and then the eye looking, depending on how you look, you can be looking at, it's both positive and negative depending on how you look at it.
But neither side looks negative to me.
It's I know.
I was thinking
you all indifferent.
Yeah.
What
like
was that?
That broken leg wasn't a negative. It was his son didn't get drafted because he had broken legs, so it ended up being a good.
Well, maybe thing. Negative isn't whatever the words they use. Like, maybe yes, maybe oh, that's a bad thing. That's terrible. Oh, maybe not. Maybe it's good. Maybe it's bad. Mm-hmm.
Great picture.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Donna.
You're welcome.
Okay, so see you in 2 weeks, but I'll see a lot of you before then.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Welcome back, Nilda.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye.